I'm Joe Graydon.
And I'm Terry Graydon. Welcome to this podcast of The People's Pharmacy.
You can find previous podcasts and more information on a range of health topics at peoplespharmacy.com. For the last 4 years, Americans have struggled with COVID-19. Now, many people just want to forget it ever occurred. This is The People's Pharmacy with Terry and Joe Graydon.
Our guest today, Dr. Paul Offit, is one of the country's leading experts on vaccines. He's a pediatrician and serves on the FDA's Vaccine Advisory Committee. He'll offer insights about navigating our post-pandemic world.
America is not just polarized politically. The pandemic created huge distrust between patients and public health officials. What lessons have we learned from this debacle?
How can we prepare for the next pandemic? Dr. Offit will share his recommendations.
Coming up on The People's Pharmacy, tell me when it's over.
In The People's Pharmacy Health Headlines, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention have recently changed the recommendations for people recovering from a respiratory infection. Until recently, those recovering from a bout of COVID-19 were urged to stay home for at least 5 days after feeling better. Now the agency says regardless of whether it was flu, COVID, RSV, or some other virus, anyone who feels better and has not taken fever-reducing medicine or had a fever for 24 hours can go back to work or school. The idea is that people are more likely to follow recommendations that are simple and clear. Many people don't know which respiratory virus made them cough or sneeze, so having a single set of guidelines could be helpful. The CDC does suggest attention to indoor air quality. This can be achieved by bringing in more fresh air from outside and purifying air circulating indoors. It also advises people to wear well-fitting masks while they're recovering, especially if they may be in contact with vulnerable individuals, such as the elderly or immune-compromised.
Long COVID has affected millions of people. The most common symptoms include fatigue, shortness of breath, and exercise intolerance. A new study in the New England Journal of Medicine, however, suggests that brain fog may also be far more common than most people realize. Researchers invited 800,000 British citizens to participate in an online survey, including cognitive assessment. Roughly 113,000 people completed all portions of the questionnaire. Those who had experienced COVID infections but recovered quickly had a small drop in IQ compared to people who did not catch COVID. In contrast, those reporting symptoms that lasted 12 weeks or more had a larger IQ deficit. Patients who reported brain fog performed less well on tests of memory, planning, and reasoning. People who eventually recovered from long COVID also performed similarly to those who had brief COVID infections. An editorial that accompanies the research calls for better understanding of cognitive dysfunction after SARS-CoV-2 infection so that we can address the needs of affected people.
Drug companies are now advertising vaccines against respiratory syncytial virus. Perhaps you've seen commercials for Arexvy and Abrysvo. At a meeting of the CDC's Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, scientists reported a slightly higher than expected risk of Guillain-Barré cases in vaccinated individuals. The background rate measured in 2022 was 5 cases per million among Americans over 65. Rates associated with the new vaccines were higher than that. Researchers point to influenza infection and flu vaccines for comparison. Flu vaccines are associated with an additional 2 cases per million doses, but influenza infection itself triggers more cases of Guillain-Barré. This rare neurological condition can lead to muscle weakness and temporary paralysis. Epidemiologists are still collecting and evaluating data regarding the possible association of RSV vaccines with Guillain-Barré syndrome.
A new study tested the effect of daily cinnamon spice supplementation on blood glucose levels. The 18 volunteers were overweight and were diagnosed with prediabetes. In this double-blind randomized clinical trial, participants got 4 grams of Indonesian cinnamon, or placebo, for a month. After a 2-week washout period, they then received the other intervention. The authors report that cinnamon lowered blood sugar relative to placebo and was well tolerated. They describe the 4-gram dose as equivalent to a typical sugar packet.
A study involving 342 Chinese adults with prehypertension showed that Tai Chi is more effective than ordinary aerobic exercise for controlling blood pressure. The study lasted a year, and the volunteers went to 4-hour-long exercise sessions per week. At the end of the study, blood pressure had dropped for both groups, but it had dropped more for those doing the slow-moving martial art of Tai Chi. And that's the health news from the People's Pharmacy this week.
Welcome to the People's Pharmacy. I'm Joe Graydon.
And I'm Terry Graydon. The COVID-19 pandemic has created a tsunami of confusion and misinformation. Many people have lost their trust in public health agencies and turned to social media and the internet for their information.
Today, we are talking with one of the country's leading experts on COVID. Dr. Paul Offit is the director of the Vaccine Education Center at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, as well as the Maurice R. Hilleman Professor of Vaccinology and a professor of pediatrics at the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania. Dr. Offit is the author of several books, including Overkill, When Modern Medicine Goes Too Far, and his most recent, Tell Me When It's Over, An Insider's Guide to Deciphering COVID Myths and Navigating Our Post-Pandemic World.
Welcome back to the People's Pharmacy, Dr. Paul Offit.
Thanks for having me.
Dr. Offit, when Terry and I were on book tours, the question that we absolutely hated the most was, why did you write this book? But I have to admit, the title of your new book, Tell Me When It's Over, really captures the mood of the country right now. So even though I hate saying it, why did you write this book?
I think for me, this pandemic has been a story of contrasts. On the one hand, you had this unusual virus, which raised its head in late 2019. It had unusual biological characteristics, unusual clinical characteristics. We isolated it, sequenced it in January 2020. Then in only 11 months, in the fastest vaccine ever made, using a technology, messenger RNA, that we had never used before, we did 2 huge clinical trials, 40,000 for Pfizer, 30,000 for Moderna, to show that the vaccine worked and was safe. I think that was the most remarkable medical or scientific achievement in my lifetime. Then what we did was we were able to mass produce, mass distribute, and mass administer a vaccine such that 70% of this population was vaccinated by July of 2021. Then we hit a wall. 30% of people in the United States simply refused to be vaccinated. As a consequence, 300,000 people died because they made that choice, because they chose not to vaccinate themselves or their family. So you had the contrast of being in a wealthy, technologically advanced country that could make a vaccine like that, and yet having a significant portion of the citizenry choosing to reject it. Why?
Dr. Offit, one of the things you address in Tell Me When It's Over is that the public perception of COVID-19 has really changed just in the last year. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. Well, so when the virus came into this country in early 2020, we didn't have anything. We were a blank slate. We didn't have antivirals, which didn't come until October of 2020. We didn't have monoclonal antibodies, which didn't come till November of 2020. We didn't have vaccines, which didn't come till December of 2020. We had nothing. all we could do was limit human-to-human contact. So we isolated, quarantined, masked, shut down businesses, shuttered schools, restricted travel. That's all we could do. And then we had vaccines, and we also had a fair amount of natural immunity. So now, probably 98%+ of the population has either been vaccinated or naturally infected or both. So we have a high level of population immunity. So the answer to the question, tell me when it's over, if you define pandemic as something that changes the way we live, work, or play, then this pandemic is over. But the virus is. The virus will continue to circulate for decades, if not longer. So what do we do now?
Well, one of the things that has affected me profoundly is our state of trust, which seems to be at an all-time low. I mean, people keep telling us that they've lost faith in the Food and Drug Administration, in the CDC, in the National Institutes of Health, the NIH, and in drug companies. And there's also this, what I would call it, an almost anti-science component to the mistrust. So I guess the big question I have for you, Dr. Offit, is there seems to be an almost cynical nature to America right now. We don't trust anybody. Why?
I agree. So I think a few reasons. I think, first of all, there's just a general anti-institutional feeling among many in this country, which is to say it's not only that they don't trust the FDA or the CDC. They don't trust the Department of Justice. They don't trust the FBI. They don't trust any sort of federal agency. I think second is, more than anything, we are very good about getting misinformation and disinformation out there that will fill any of the conspiracy theories that you have. And third, and this is probably the hardest part, I mean, the fact remains that we learn as we go. We were learning about this virus. We were learning about this disease. We were learning about this vaccine or these vaccines in real time. And not everything we did was right, because there's always a process of evolution. And that learning curve invariably is steep, and it invariably comes with a human price. And that was true here, too. The Johnson & Johnson vaccine, for example, which was authorized in February of 2021, was found to be a very rare cause of clotting, including clotting in the brain, including fatal clotting in the brain, which caused that vaccine to go off the market in May of last year. And people look at that and they say, see, these people don't know what they're doing, because we're just uncomfortable with the fluidity of scientific knowledge. You know, we'd like to think you know everything right now, when that's pretty much never true.
Dr. Offit, I have told you in the past a personal story. It has to do when I was a little over 2, maybe 3 years of age. I ended up at CHOP, which is where you are, the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, with a diagnosis of polio. And in those days, polio was often a death sentence or would lead to permanent disability and paralysis. And I couldn't see my parents for weeks on end. I mean, they would come on Sundays, and I could wave at them through the little window at the end of that children's ward at the hospital that you work at. But it was devastating for them. It was devastating for me. I was in traction. Children were dying around me. And later in my life, I had whooping cough, and freaked my parents out, because whooping cough often killed children in those days. This anti-vax movement of the last decade, but especially of the last couple of years, is personal for me, because my kids aren't going to get polio. And I know you too spent time in a polio ward for different reasons, because of surgery. Can you tell us a little bit about your personal feelings about this anti-vax movement? Because you have served on the vaccine advisory committee for the Food and Drug Administration. So you've probably seen it up close and personal.
Right. And I've served on the so-called advisory committee for immunization practices to the CDC. So I've been on both those committees. But no, you're right. I think vaccines are a victim of their own success. People just don't realize what these viruses could do. I'll tell you one interesting story. When we had a large number of people from Afghanistan emigrating into the United States, polio circulated in Afghanistan, and only about one of every couple hundred people who get paralyzed by polio were infected. So in other words, only one of 200 people who are infected will be paralyzed. So the paralysis is just the tip of a much larger iceberg. And I remember when those children were coming to a camp actually not far from our hospital and were starting to be admitted to the hospital for a variety of reasons, I said to the chief residents in pediatrics, you know, I think we should consider screening the stools of these people who are coming into the hospital to see whether they're shedding poliovirus, because wild-type polio, natural poliovirus, was still circulating in Afghanistan. And they looked at me like I was from another planet. What are you talking about? Polio? I mean, this to them was just a disease in black and white pictures. It wasn't a disease that still occurred in this world, but obviously it still is a disease that occurs in this world. But the look on their face was one of absolute panic. Because polio was, as you know, a crippling disease. We'd see 30,000 children paralyzed by that virus every year. We'd see 1,500 children die from that virus every year. And now, because of the polio vaccine, we don't see that. And that's the problem. It's not just that we've eliminated these viruses. We've eliminated the memory of these viruses. And that has made us complacent.
Well, in fact, I think measles is another good example. I think nowadays, if you say we're worried about measles making a comeback, which they are doing, the virus is doing in some places, people don't really understand why that would be serious. But I remember in the early 1970s, when I was doing my field research in anthropology in Oaxaca, Mexico, if you talked about measles, the mothers would look terrified, and they'd talk about the ravages, because measles can kill kids.
Right. So we had a measles vaccine that was first introduced in the United States in 1963. Before that, every year we would have roughly 3 to 4 million people who would get measles, mostly children less than 15. We would have 48,000 hospitalizations, typically from severe dehydration or pneumonia, or encephalitis, which is infection of the brain, and we'd have 500 children die every year. Measles makes you sick. I can tell whether or not a child has measles, because if they look relatively well, because there are a number of viruses that can cause fever and a rash, then it's not measles. Measles makes you sick. Those children are miserable. And a large percentage of them, actually, if you just got chest x-rays, have abnormal chest x-rays. Measles is a pneumonia, and I don't think people realize just how sick or worse measles can make you. But again, the virus is a victim of our own success. We had a child at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia come into our hospital with measles recently, and then it started actually a local outbreak of measles. And it was interesting looking around the room. These are infectious disease experts in a pediatric hospital. Most of those people had never seen a case of measles.
You're listening to Dr. Paul Offit, director of the Vaccine Education Center at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. His latest book is Tell Me When It's Over, An Insider's Guide to Deciphering COVID Myths and Navigating Our Post-Pandemic World.
After the break, we'll get Dr. Offit's thoughts on how public health officials can rebuild trust.
People can have drastically different experiences from a COVID infection. Find out why.
What about long COVID? Is there any way to reduce our risks?
You're listening to The People's Pharmacy with Joe and Terry Graydon.
This podcast is made possible in part by Cocovia, maker of the most proven and concentrated flavanol extract in the market today, CocoPro Cocoa Extract.
March is National Nutrition Month. By now, you may have heard about the heart and brain health benefits of flavanols. The Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics recommends a daily intake of 400 to 600 milligrams of flavanols from a variety of foods and drinks, such as tea, apples, berries, and cocoa, to support cardiometabolic health. Yes, you can achieve this guideline through diet, but consider how the convenience of taking a cocoa flavanol supplement like Cocovia can help fill gaps during busiest days.
Get 15% off your Cocovia order from March 7th through March 26th using the discount code NNM That's NNM2024 at CocoVia.com. Again, N as in Nancy, N as in Nancy, M as in Mary, 2024, NNM2024.
These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Welcome back to The People's Pharmacy. I'm Joe Graydon.
And I'm Terry Graydon. The People's Pharmacy is made possible in part by CocoVia Dietary Supplements. March is National Nutrition Month. Consider how CocoVia's cocoa flavanols can be part of your nutrition routine. More information at CocoVia.com.
Today, we are taking a careful look at what happened during the last 4 years with COVID-19. The pandemic has been declared over, yet the virus is still part of our everyday life. In fact, last December, nearly 10 times more Americans died from COVID-19 than from the flu. How should that knowledge shape our behavior going forward? What might we have learned about protecting ourselves from future pandemics?
Dr. Paul Offit is director of the Vaccine Education Center at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, as well as the Maurice R. Hilleman Professor of Vaccinology and Professor of Pediatrics at the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania. Dr. Offit is a member of the FDA's Vaccine Advisory Committee. He's written several books, including Overkill: When Modern Medicine Goes Too Far, and Tell Me When It's Over, An Insider's Guide to Deciphering COVID Myths and Navigating Our Post-Pandemic World.
Dr. Offit, it seemed as though opposition to vaccinations in general was fading prior to the pandemic, but in the last 3 years, vaccine skepticism has gained momentum. Why do you think that is?
Well, you're right. Without question, it has gathered momentum. If you had asked me coming into this pandemic, what did I think would happen to the anti-vaccine movement? I thought it would only be further hurt by the fact that we now had a vaccine, a ticket out of this pandemic, and vaccines would be seen for what they were, which is a hero. And if anything, the anti-vaccine movement was fading, I think, prior to this pandemic. People like Andrew Wakefield, who had claimed falsely that the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine had caused autism, his voice had dimmed, as had the voice of other anti-vaccine activists, like Robert F. Kennedy Jr., Del Bigtree, or Barbara Lou Fisher. But what happened with this pandemic is when we mandated vaccines and fired people from their jobs because they chose not to get vaccinated, and people couldn't go to the bar they wanted to go to, or the restaurant they wanted to go to, or the sporting event, or a religious ceremony, that really galvanize a certain percentage of the population. I think we leaned into this libertarian left hook, that there never really was a politics to the anti-vaccine movement, in the sense that on the left, it was the kind of don't inject me with anything unnatural, like a buffering agent or stabilizing agent or manufacturing residual or preservative or an activating agent, and anything with a chemical name. Don't inject me with that. It's sort of the all-natural crowd. And that was sort of the measles epidemic in Southern California in 2014, 2015, that started in a heavily sort of left-leaning area near Disneyland. But now it's really a phenomenon of the right. And it's this libertarian, I don't want the government to tell me what to do, because that's what you're seeing now, this real sort of pushback against the federal government with regard to anything the federal government wants to do. And in this case, it's mandating vaccines. And as a consequence, there have been hundreds and hundreds of pieces of legislation pushing back against the ability of public health to isolate, quarantine, insist on masking, insist on vaccinating. And those are, you know, important weapons for public health to help control these pandemics. I think in many ways, we're going to be less capable of handling the next pandemic because of the pushback we've gotten from this one.
I'm wondering if we can just talk a little bit about how the virus operates for a few minutes. And what I'd like to know is, why do different people have such different experiences when they come down with COVID?
Well, we're an outbred population, so we respond differently to viruses and bacteria. This virus attaches itself to cells that line the nose and throat. It reproduces itself. And then in many, it causes typically mild or moderate symptoms. But in some, it causes severe symptoms that can lead to hospitalization or intensive care unit admission or death, and most commonly pneumonia. And usually that those severe cases involve high-risk groups, people who are elderly, and I now define elderly as over 75 because, you know, I'm getting there, and people who have high-risk medical conditions like chronic heart disease, lung disease, diabetes, obesity, people who are pregnant, and people who are immune compromised. That's usually who you see coming into the hospital and dying, especially now that we have a vaccine and we have a high level of immunity induced by natural infection.
Dr. Offit, what's been fascinating to me is we get a lot of messages from people who say, natural immunity, that's what we need. You know, the more stuff you catch, the better you'll be. Just eat a well-balanced diet. Just exercise. Everybody's going to be fine. Don't vaccinate. Don't worry. Don't take drugs, antiviral drugs. What a waste. And then I think, wait a minute. I could have died with both polio and whooping cough as a kid. And there are a lot of viral infections that make you super sick, like norovirus. I don't want to catch norovirus and have diarrhea and throw up, you know, nonstop for hours. Where is this natural immunity thing coming from?
The word natural. I really want to give credit to Mother Nature's public relations team. Mother Nature has been trying to kill us ever since we crawled out of the ocean onto land. I'm not sure why it is that there's such cachet to the term natural infection, which to me is a contradiction in terms. I think the term should be survivor immunity. I mean, natural infection is clearly a value because in this case of, say, SARS-CoV-2, you're developing an immune response to all four viral proteins, not just the one viral protein you're getting in the vaccine. But the problem with natural infection is you might die acquiring it. The goal of a vaccine is to induce the protection that's that's consequent of natural infection without having to pay the price of natural infection. I mean, you know, people walk away from car crashes, but they're lucky. And that doesn't mean a car crash is a good thing.
Well, I'd actually like to explore this natural immunity idea just a little bit further, because people will say to me, well, the vaccine, it doesn't really work. It certainly isn't quite as effective as we originally thought. The original presentation of how effective it was, I think, was overrepresented. But people say, well, even if you're vaccinated, you can still catch COVID. And that part's true. But also, even if you've had COVID once, you can still catch it again. So this natural immunity is actually not a perfect shield.
The goal of the vaccine, or frankly, the consequence of natural infection, is to protect you against severe disease. That's the goal. And I think you're absolutely right. I think we confused people early on in this pandemic. When we sat down in December of 2020, we being the FDA Vaccine Advisory Committee, to look at those two big studies by Pfizer and Moderna, what you saw is that the protection against mild, moderate, and severe disease was in the 95% range. But what I think people didn't realize, those were three-month studies. Those participants had just gotten their second dose. So they had a high level of circulating antibodies, which will protect them against mild disease, but not for long. And therefore, 6 months later, while protection against severe disease, say in mid-2021, was high, protection against mild disease was fading. And there's probably no better example of how we miscommunicated this than July 4th of 2021, when thousands of men got together to celebrate the July 4th holiday in Provincetown, Massachusetts. 80% were vaccinated. There were 346 men who, despite being vaccinated, got COVID. Four were hospitalized. That's a hospitalization rate of 1.2%. That's a vaccine working very well. The remaining 342 had mild or asymptomatic infection, which the CDC, in their report of this particular outbreak, labeled as breakthrough infections. Bad word. Breakthrough implies failure. This wasn't a failure. This is exactly what you wanted to have happen. You had taken a disease which could cause severe and fatal infection, and then reduced it to be a mild infection in those 342 men. And I think that if you watched, I remember I was on CNN at one point around then, and in the segment before mine, they were talking about Brett Kavanaugh, Supreme Court Justice. He goes into the Supreme Court chamber. Before he goes, he's screened. He's asymptomatic, and yet he's positive. So he has an asymptomatic infection. If you watch the way that was carried on national media, you would have thought the man was fighting for his life. Lindsey Graham actually got this right. He too had at that point, because this is mid-2021, he'd had two doses of vaccine. He got COVID. He had a several-day illness associated with mild sinusitis. And he said, and I quote, "This would have been much worse if I hadn't been vaccinated." Exactly right. Lindsey Graham actually got that exactly right.
Dr. Offutt, a lot of people say, well, it's no big deal. I mean, it's just like the flu. And, you know, you'll get over it a couple of days, no problem. Except there's this thing called long COVID. And, I can't tell you how many people have contacted us who say, my life has been changed permanently, or at least seemingly permanently. It's been more than months, it's now years, and I can't exercise. The fatigue is overwhelming. I stand up and I fall down. Tell us about long COVID, its public health consequences, some of the symptoms, and how far we're coming when it comes to potential treatments.
So long COVID, I think, is more than one thing, which is to say that it has a variety of different causes or possible causes. So one possible cause is that the virus continues to reproduce itself. Or another possible cause is that the immune system is sort of super activated. And even though the virus isn't reproducing itself, it's as if the virus is still reproducing itself because the immune system is turned on. Another possibility is that there are these sort of small micro blood clots that can be distributed throughout the lung and other organs. And then another possible pathogenesis or cause is that it's hard to suffer a severe disease, and that there can be sort of psychological consequences to suffering that. But the COVID is not unique in being able to cause long-term symptoms. A flu also can cause long-term symptoms, meaning influenza virus, as can hepatitis B virus, as can the virus that causes mononucleosis called Epstein-Barr virus. So it's not unique. I think we've gotten a lot of attention focused on this, which is good because it is debilitating and it does require, I think, our attention. I think we will learn more about this over time. But I think that the data to date suggests that if you've gotten, you will have the lowest chance of having long COVID if you've gotten at least three doses. It doesn't look like there's any advantage to having doses of the vaccine beyond three doses, but three doses does clearly lessen your chance of having long COVID, as does apparently taking Paxlovid early, because all of those things reduce the degree to which the virus is capable of reproducing itself.
What about support groups? We have observed the development of support groups in which people with long COVID are helping each other.
And that's great. I think it's always nice to have people who have experienced something similar to what you've experienced. I think that sort of creates a community of support that is outstanding. So I think that's great. And I feel badly, I guess, as a member of the medical community, that we haven't quite nailed down exactly what the different causes of this phenomenon are. Because I think that when you talk about treatment, there's going to be different treatments. If, for example, the problem was one of persistent viral replication, then you want an antiviral. If the problem is one of sort of a hyperactive immune system, then you want drugs that dampen the immune system. If the problem is one of clotting, which is true, certainly in some cases, then you want things that, you know, thin the blood. So there are, or if it's a psychological issue, then you want that kind of support. But I think, you know, it's we just haven't quite gotten on top of this phenomenon yet.
Dr. Offutt, I would like to think about what comes next. And specifically, what strategies do you envision for combating either the spread of COVID or future viruses, which we all anticipate we will be encountering?
Right. So I think for now, what makes the most sense to me is what most countries are doing, which is to target high-risk groups, those four high-risk groups, the elderly, people who have chronic medical conditions, people who are immunocompromised, people who are pregnant. Most countries do that. Countries in Europe, Australia, the Scandinavian countries, World Health Organization, all recommends targeting high-risk groups. Really, it's only the U.S. and Canada that say everybody over 6 months of age should get a yearly COVID vaccine, thus likening it to influenza. I do think, though, that there will be another pandemic is clear. We had a pandemic virus, SARS-1, that raised its head in 2002. 10 years later, you had the second pandemic, coronavirus, MERS, which raised its head in 2012. Now you have this virus, which raised its head in 2019. I think what's happened is with deforestation and with sort of bats becoming closer and closer to interacting with other mammals, you have these coronavirus animal-to-human spillover events. And I think those kind of spillover events actually happen all the time. I just think there's moments when it hits exactly right in the right population and then spreads. So this will happen again. I do feel that I hope that we learn from this so that we can be better next time, especially with regard to one of your early questions. I mean, how can we regain the trust in public health agencies? Because we need public health agencies. We need to be able to trust the science. And I fear that science is just losing its place as a source of trust. It's just becoming another voice in the room.
Well, let me climb on my soapbox just for a moment, because I think our public health organizations have let us down when it comes to one thing in particular: air quality. I want to know why the CDC and the public health agencies haven't emphasized proper ventilation, air filtration, CO2 monitors. I mean, why aren't all public buildings having better air quality? And why can't we look at a CO2 monitor to see before we walk into the pharmacy or a supermarket, oh man, the air quality really sucks in this building, I'm not going in?
Right. I'm not sure that's my specific area of expertise, but I do agree with you. I think that if you look at buildings, for example, that have the best kind of HVAC systems, which can, you know, filter out the kinds of the particles that are the size that would contain, say, SARS-CoV-2 virus, you definitely lessen the spread inside buildings. And there are people that do it. Daniel Griffin, for example, who's on something called This Week in Virology, often goes through exactly what you're saying. But you're right. I think that the CDC could take a lead on this, or even the FDA. I guess my frustration a little bit here is that I think that those agencies are a little gun shy, because what they should do is they should get out there every other day and explain the science behind policy decisions. So, for example, recently the CDC changed its policy regarding how long one should isolate, you know, following a COVID infection, which is fine.
I'm going to ask you, Dr. Offutt, I'm going to ask you to hold that thought, because that's a really important issue. We're going to come back to it right after the break.
You're listening to Dr. Paul Offutt. He's the director of the Vaccine Education Center at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. He also holds the title of Maurice R. Hilleman Professor of Vaccinology and is a professor of pediatrics at the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania. Dr. Offutt is the author of several books, including Overkill: When Modern Medicine Goes Too Far, and his most recent, Tell Me When It's Over: An Insider's Guide to Deciphering COVID Myths and Navigating Our Post-Pandemic World.
After the break, we'll find out why rebuilding trust is so crucial to future public health efforts.
Will the CDC's recent change in policy help with that?
What can we do going forward?
What lessons have we learned, and which ones should we have learned?
Dr. Offutt will suggest some steps for worldwide preparation for future pandemics, as well as his hopes for the future.
You're listening to The People's Pharmacy with Joe and Terry Graydon.
This podcast is brought to you in part by Urea Skin Relief from The People's Pharmacy. After years of work, we've gotten the formula just right. We're delighted to be offering this intensive skin therapy with 20% urea.
Urea Skin Relief Cream is not your average moisturizer. Formulated with a unique blend of urea and plant-based ingredients, it's specifically designed to deeply hydrate and soothe even the most stubborn dry skin. Whether you're battling the effects of harsh weather or you have sensitive skin that's prone to irritation, this cream works wonders.
Urea is a powerhouse ingredient. Not only does it act as a humectant, drawing moisture into the skin, it also beefs up the skin's barrier function. We're just as proud of what you won't find in our Urea Skin Relief Cream, no parabens or phthalates. Creating a cream for dry skin free of these common endocrine-disrupting preservatives and plasticizers was what motivated us to make this product.
We're offering a limited-time discount for People's Pharmacy podcast listeners. You can get 20% off either the handy 2-ounce size or the hefty 6-ounce size of the People's Pharmacy Urea Skin Relief. You'll find them both in the body care section of the store at peoplespharmacy.com.
Make sure you put the code PP20 into the discount code box when you check out. That's capital P, capital P, PP20 for 20% off your Urea Skin Relief purchase through May 31, 2024 at peoplespharmacy.com.
Welcome back to The People's Pharmacy. I'm Terry Graydon.
And I'm Joe Graydon. The People's Pharmacy is made possible in part by Cocovia Dietary Supplements. March is National Nutrition Month. Consider how Cocovia cocoa flavanols can be part of your nutrition routine. More information at cocovia.com.
Today, we're discussing how well public health officials reacted to the pandemic. What could organizations like the CDC or WHO have done better? As a consequence of their actions and inactions, many public health agencies lost the public's trust and will now need to rebuild it. Looking back at the pandemic, what lessons should all of us take forward for future health emergencies?
We are talking with Dr. Paul Offit. He is the director of the Vaccine Education Center, the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, as well as the Maurice R. Hilleman Professor of Vaccinology and a professor of pediatrics at the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania. Dr. Offit is the author of several books, including Overkill, When Modern Medicine Goes Too Far, and his most recent, Tell Me When It's Over, An Insider's Guide to Deciphering COVID Myths and Navigating Our Post-Pandemic World.
Dr. Offit, we've seen that it takes a long time to build up trust. It doesn't take very long to break it down. The CDC is kind of laboring now to try to rebuild the trust that it lost with the American public. And I'm wondering how their recent contemplation that they would just drop the recommendation that if you test positive for COVID, that you should isolate yourself for 5 days. How will that play into rebuilding trust or not?
So I actually agree with the recommendation, and I'll explain to you why. And then I'll hopefully answer the question about how I think how they can regain trust. This infection occurs in two phases. Phase one is the virus reproduction phase. It occurs very early on. The virus reproduces itself again and again and again. That's when you're most contagious. Then is phase two, is the immune response phase. That's when you make antibodies to try and prevent the virus from binding to cells, or you make something called cytotoxic T cells, which kill virus-infected cells. That's when you develop symptoms, is when the immune system kicks in. It's the immune system that causes the symptoms. So what the CDC was saying is, when you start to feel better, and you have at least one day where you're not febrile, what that means is that you're now sort of in the late second stage where virus replication is not an important part of the disease process at all anymore. And so you really, at that point, are far less contagious than you were early on. You never get to the zero point, but unless you just stay home, for 14 days. But they're trying to tie it to the person. instead of just giving a specific number of days, at least one afebrile day. And I think that makes abundant sense. The other thing I think that would make the most sense is that if you're in a high-risk group, like those high-risk groups we talked about, and you have respiratory symptoms, congestion, cough, runny nose, headache, et cetera, test yourself. If you're positive, then treat yourself with an antiviral, preferably in the first few days. If you're not in a high-risk group, don't test yourself. Assume that you have COVID or influenza, respiratory syncytial virus, or any of the other winter viruses, all of which can cause people to suffer, all of which can cause people to be hospitalized, and all of which can cause people to die. And stay home. Stay home while you're sick. And when you feel better and you have at least one day of not having fever, then you can go back out again. And if you have to go out again while you're sick, with either in a high-risk group or not in a high-risk group, wear a mask. I was in an airport recently where there was a man who was walking around who worked for the airport, and he was sort of, you know, collecting trash and sort of sweeping up. And he had a runny nose and a cough, and he was wiping his nose on his sleeve. And this was in Florida, and there was generally an elderly group sitting around. And one person asked him, "Did you test yourself to see whether you had COVID?" And he said, "Yes, he did." But see, that doesn't therefore mean that he's not infected with a virus that can cause harm. You know, two years before SARS-CoV-2 came into this country, the cause of COVID, there were 800,000 hospitalizations from flu and 60,000 deaths. I mean, why do we grandfather that in? I mean, there's 10,000 to 14,000 older adults who die every year from RSV, respiratory syncytial virus. And somehow those are all grandfathered, and all of these viruses can be harmful. So why don't we care about our neighbor, stay home when you're sick, and if you can't stay home, wear a mask.
Dr. Offit, we have lost so much trust in this country between health professionals and the public, between politicians and the public, between politicians and the scientific community. How can we regain trust? What should we do going forward?
I think the scientific and medical community, especially through agencies like the CDC, need to be out there all the time explaining why we're doing what we're doing, what we know and what we don't know, about how we acquire knowledge over time, that there often is a learning curve, and we need to be patient with that learning curve. And I do think that that would help rather than sort of standing back and making just declarations for what we should do. I think it would help to explain why we're doing what we're doing.
Well, I'm going to suggest that there is something that we could do as a society that would help people, like the janitor in the Florida airport, actually stay home. But my guess is he probably doesn't have paid sick leave. What do you think about that?
I completely agree. I think that is a major failure. There's just an article by Liz Sabo that was in, I think it was in Kaiser Family Foundation publication, that said exactly that. We are terrible in this country about giving people the time off they need to recover, which is short-sighted, because all that's going to happen is that people are sort of forced to come into work and thus infect other people, which only lessens the workforce. So I completely agree. I think that is a major problem.
I hate to open this can of worms, but I cannot tell you how many people have contacted us to say, "Masks don't work. What's the matter with you? Nobody needs a mask." And I'm curious about the science, because I guess the science could be better. I would love to see, you know, humongous research on this. But what I've noticed is that people wear their masks in all sorts of ridiculous ways.
I mean, a lot of them wear a mask as a chin diaper.
Or under their nose. It's like, "Oh, I don't like wearing a mask, but I've got it on." And, you know, but then there are these huge gaps around their cheeks. And it's like, well, why would anybody think that a mask that doesn't fit well is going to work? So give us the, you know, 1 minute overview on masking, please.
So masks work, but they're not absolute. So if you look at sort of the best mask, which is the N95 mask, it's sort of in the high 90% range of protecting others from you or you from others. If you look just at the KN95, now you drop down to the low 90% range. If you look at just the surgical masks that people often wear around hospitals, now you're sort of in the high 80% range, assuming you wear the mask correctly. It makes sense, right? I mean, the virus is spread in small droplets, though the size of those particles is larger than the size, the pore size of the mask. So it would make sense if you have a reasonably tightly fitting mask that it would work. But it's the same thing that was alluded to earlier. It doesn't absolutely work. And the same thing with the vaccine. The vaccine doesn't absolutely protect you against transmitting the virus, and it doesn't absolutely protect you against mild disease. And I think we were so bad at communicating that. And the reason is because we mandated vaccines. So when you mandate a vaccine, you say you can't even come to work or you're fired from your job unless you get a vaccine. And then the vaccine is perceived as not being perfectly effective. You know, people get angry. And I think that was a massive communications error by not explaining what this vaccine can and can't do. This is a short incubation period mucosal infection like flu or like RSV. You're not going to be protected against mild disease for long. That's always true. And I think that was confusing to people.
Well, Dr. Offit, that kind of takes us to the next place I'd like to go. What the final chapter in Tell Me When It's Over is about lessons learned. And I'd like to kind of have us explore what we should have learned from this pandemic and what maybe we have learned.
So there were certainly bright lights in this pandemic. I think one thing was the rapidity with which we could make a vaccine against a novel pathogen using a technology, messenger RNA, which we had no previous experience. That was remarkable. And it tells you how quickly we can make a vaccine. And even more importantly, in a country that doesn't really have an infrastructure for mass vaccinating adults, we created one and gave this vaccine out for free. That's amazing. And then I think you have people like Ayla Stanford, who I talk about in this book, who is an African-American surgeon at Temple University, who created something called the Black Doctors COVID Consortium. And she goes into North Philadelphia with people who are working with her at her own expense and sits in people's living rooms and explains to them why they need a vaccine. And she comes back again and again and ultimately vaccinates 50,000 people in that community. We need 1,000 Ayla Stanfords who various communities trust. We need to identify who are viewed as people who are trusted in various communities, because I think that's where it has to happen. I don't think it can really happen at the federal or state level. I think it has to happen at the local level. So those are the good things, I think, that came out of this pandemic. What worries me is that I just think we didn't care about our neighbor in large part. People just thought about themselves. There are 9 million people in this country who can't be vaccinated because they're immune compromised. They depend on those around them to protect them. And I think we just don't care as much about them, which is sad because I think it's in us. I mean, I think, you know, we all certainly pulled together after 9/11. We all pulled together after we were attacked at Pearl Harbor. I think we do have it in us to see ourselves as a whole as compared to a group of individuals. And that's what we have to be able to get to handle the next pandemic.
Well, there will be a next pandemic. And I think one of the things that we have learned with regard to COVID-19 is that there are some strategies, one of which was wastewater surveillance. Can you tell us why that's important and why it might be important going forward?
Right. So what we will traditionally do, for example, if you looked at South Korea when that virus first hit, they were very good about testing. They tested everybody often, and they got their tests out much quicker than we did. So that tells you sort of where the hotspots are. Well, another way to tell where the hotspots are is to look at wastewater surveillance. So you can see whether this particular virus is starting to increase in a community by looking at wastewaters to tell you this is a high-risk community, this is a hot community, and you need to be especially careful there that you may get this virus. And if you do, treat yourself early. And if you are sick, please stay home because it may well be this virus or any of the virus that can be problematic. So, yeah, I think that's another thing that came out of this pandemic that was a plus.
How can we end up being prepared for the next challenge of this sort?
Well, hopefully we've learned from this about the things that we can do and the things that we shouldn't do. And I think I really do think that we need to be honest with the American public about what we know at the time. And if we don't get it right, so for example, the bivalent vaccine was not a bad idea. Here, Omicron had come into the country. Why are we still just giving that original vaccine, the so-called ancestral strain vaccine? Shouldn't we at least include the Omicron variant or one of the Omicron variants in the vaccine. And we gave sort of a half dose of the ancestral strain, a half a dose of the bivalent strain, and it was no better than what we had. I mean, any scientist that looked at those data knew that it was no better. It was no worse, but it was no better. It wasn't a bad idea. It just wasn't right. And I think what has to happen, really, I think the CDC, in moments like this, should be out in front of the American public every other day, explaining, look, here's what we know, here's what we're trying to know, and just be honest with the American public when we don't get it exactly right. Because I think that would help, I think, a significant portion of this population to understand that we're all trying, and that you know, science evolves, that we learn over time, and we're being open-minded to that knowledge. And I think that would really help, rather than just giving directives. That happened in August of 2021, when President Biden stood up and said, as of the week of September 20th, we are going to recommend a third dose, a booster dose for everybody over 12. Like, what? So that, I mean, there were people at the FDA that quit associated with that. It went to the FDA advisory committee, which said no. It went to the CDC advisory committee, which said no. And so now people were confused. What did it mean to be fully protected? And then you had phrases like being fully protected or being up to date, and it was confusing to people. I think it's still confusing to people. And what would make it less confusing is, I think, especially the CDC, because that's where these recommendations are coming from, they need to stand up in front of the American public often and do that. Just one quick story, if I have a minute. Richard Besser was the head of the CDC in 2009 when swine flu hit. And he was great. He was out in front of the community, the media every few days, which is to say he was answering their questions and the public's questions. And I saw him at a recent meeting, and I said that. I said, you were great. He said, thank you. I could never do it today. Two reasons, politics and social media.
Which presents quite a challenge.
For sure. I mean, trying to stop the misinformation and disinformation on social media is like trying to stop Hurricane Katrina with a plastic cup. I think people try. It's just hard.
Dr. Offit, I would like to ask you about the worldwide preparation, because there has been a lot of criticism of the World Health Organization. When the pandemic first hit, a lot of countries said, well, we're gonna close off our borders. No airplanes, no ships coming into our country. That way we can keep the virus out. Will that ever work?
No. In a word, no. I also think, just in terms of being prepared next time, I think China was a bad actor here. I mean, they didn't let the world know what was going on. Ultimately, it took a whistleblower, an ophthalmologist, who stood up and said, look, there's a virus circulating in this country that's killing people, and it's a novel pathogen. And it shouldn't have come to that. And China was also pretty xenophobic in terms of letting other scientists come in to evaluate very carefully what was going on there. You need to know these things. You need to know what are the factors that are in place that allow a pandemic to start. And as a consequence, I think it gave birth to conspiracy theories.
Dr. Paul Offit, in the minute we have left, what are your hopes for the future?
Right. Well, I'm a Philadelphia Eagles season ticket holder, so I'm an optimistic person. But I do think that there are a number of things that came out of this pandemic that will be instructive for the next one. And I really do think that we will learn many of those lessons because we paid such a high price for this.
Dr. Paul Offit, thank you so much for talking with us on The People's Pharmacy today about your brand new book, Tell Me When It's Over.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Dr. Paul Offit, director of the Vaccine Education Center at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. Dr. Offit also serves as the Maurice R. Hilleman Professor of Vaccinology and Professor of Pediatrics at the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania. Dr. Offit is a member of the FDA's Vaccine Advisory Committee and served previously on the CDC's Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices. He's written a number of books, including Overkill, When Modern Medicine Goes Too Far, and his most recent, Tell Me When It's Over, An Insider's Guide to Deciphering COVID Myths and Navigating Our Post-Pandemic World.
Lynn Siegel produced today's show. Al Wodarski engineered. Dave Graydon edits our interviews. BJ Lederman composed our theme music.
This show is a co-production of North Carolina Public Radio WUNC with The People's Pharmacy.
The People's Pharmacy is made possible in part by Cocovia Dietary Supplements. March is National Nutrition Month. consider how Cocovia's cocoa flavanols can be a part of your nutrition routine. More information at cocovia.com.
Today's show is number 1377. You can find it online at peoplespharmacy.com. That's where you can share your comments about today's interview. You can also reach us through email, radio@peoplespharmacy.com.
Our interviews are available through your favorite podcast provider. You'll find the show on our website on Monday morning.
At peoplespharmacy.com, you could sign up for our free online newsletter and get the latest news about important health stories. When you subscribe, you also get regular access to information about our weekly podcast. That way you can find out ahead of time what topics we're covering.
In Durham, North Carolina, I'm Joe Graydon.
And I'm Terry Graydon. Thank you for listening. Please join us again next week. Thank you for listening to the People's Pharmacy Podcast. It's an honor and a pleasure to bring you our award-winning program week in and week out. But producing and distributing this show as a free podcast takes time and costs money.
If you like what we do and you'd like to help us continue to produce high-quality, independent healthcare journalism, please consider chipping in.
All you have to do is go to peoplespharmacy.com/donate.
Whether it's just one time or a monthly donation, you can be part of the team that makes this show possible. Thank you for your continued loyalty and support. We couldn't make our show without you.